As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to The View from the Lane, the Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. I'm Danny Kelly. I'll explain why I'm using somebody else's voice in just a second. And I'm joined on a podcast today by the full crew, the entire posse, Charlie Eccleshare, Jack Pitbrook, and James Moore, who were all at the stadium to watch Spurs' magnificent 3-0 win over Arsenal last night. So I'm Danny Kelly. This is not really my normal voice, but in a first for podcasting, I think, globally, I am doing it while in the absolute throes of one of the worst kinds of reactions to COVID-19. And just my colleagues watching, just to prove how this is going, as you can see, I am wearing an oximeter on my finger as we speak, which was the cause yesterday of an ambulance having to be called for me. But I wouldn't have missed the game, and I wouldn't have missed this for almost anything. I would have taken the advice of the paramedics if they said I had to be hospitalised. Listen, I can't wait to hear all about your experiences. James, I'll start with you. For us Spurs fans who weren't there, what was that atmosphere like?
Yeah, it was incredible. That game was always going to be, up to this point, the best or the worst at the stadium for Spurs fans. It was always going to be like a massive win that was going to put the pressure on Arsenal in this race for a Champions League place, or drop points that were going to effectively end it, or mathematically end it even, which obviously would have been a complete nightmare. So I think everyone knew. I don't think there can have been anyone who didn't kind of realise exactly what was on the line. And yeah, it was that kind of old school intensity to the crowd that I don't think we've had too many times in the new stadium. It did feel much more like White Hart Lane. I can't think of like a kind of consistent noise like that in that ground. Even the Champions League games against Man City and Ajax, I don't think the noise was quite as like vociferous or consistent as that throughout those matches. It was, obviously the way the first half went was a big contributing factor to that, but I can't think of too many times where it would have been anywhere near that level.
The first 10 minutes, when the noise that the Spurs fans made whenever Arsenal had the ball, and they had quite a lot of possession in the first 10 minutes, it really did feel like you were in one of those really hostile, intimidating away grounds on the continent. It was amazing. And that is when the acoustics of that South Stand, me and my colleagues talking, were just like this, you really can't hear anything. And you were thinking for the players, and the managers were trying to get their instructions across, and you were like, don't even bother, because the noise, the way it reverberated, it really was quite an incredible thing to just sit back and take in.
Really interesting, the way of watching it from a distance as well. And the build-up on Instagram just was showing pictures of outside the ground, and you got it exactly right there. It looked like a Spanish or Italian ground before one of their big matches. And as I watched it on the TV, with the sound up at pretty much, you know, Woodstock levels, I did think this is what this stadium was built for, wasn't it? That inward amplification, if that's the right word, on top of the players. Jack, what did you make of the ground, the fans, and the atmosphere on the night?
Yeah, brilliant. I think it was probably the best. It's kind of hard for me to specifically remember the atmosphere in the Ajax and the City games in 2019, but I doubt it would have been, as like James said, I doubt it would have been as consistently good as that. The noise for the first goal was amazing. It's like, you know, you feel like, you know, even sat in the press box, you feel like you are getting battered by these kind of waves of noise crashing over you. as you sit there. And then it didn't really let up at all. And in the second half, the atmosphere was weirdly jubilant. Like, they were not weirdly jubilant. It was kind of unusually jubilant for a game like that, you know, in the sense that the Tottenham fans were olaying passes on about 58 minutes. So, yeah, from an atmosphere perspective, I've never really seen anything like it at that stadium.
Well, and I must admit, I thought that the fans would have their job to do when I got the completely unexpected news before the start that Christian Romero wasn't starting. I've got to be honest, I'm a weak heart. I immediately thought, oh, that's it then, isn't it? He's 10% of the outfield players, but he's 30% of the outfield output, isn't he? He's with spirit, forward passing, and the tackling. He's much more than just 10% of the team. Has it happened? It didn't need that. I'm going to just say one thing to you all, though. We will no doubt discuss until we all go, be careful what you say here, Danny Blue in the face, the effect of this game on the race for the Champions League and all the rest of it. First and foremost, let's get it right. That was a 3-0 victory in the North London Derby. That's what Spurs need to do. They need to beat Arsenal first and foremost. And I think I'm right saying it was the biggest victory since, well, none of you three were alive the last time Spurs won 3-0. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
That's right. 1983.
83 was their last win. It was 5-0. It was big. I mean, it was their biggest Premier League win ever over Arsenal, which felt like a bit of a trick of the mind because it was so comfortable and routine. Like, if you... I mean, James, you'll remember that 5-1 in the League Cup in 2008 or the 5-1 over Chelsea in the League Cup in 2002. Both of them felt like day of days. You know, everything has just gone right and we have battered them. This felt... I think if you were imagining the biggest ever win over a margin of victory ever in the Premier League over Arsenal, you'd probably have imagined a more, I don't know, it to feel more extraordinary. This was just weirdly easy. And I know, obviously, that, you know, a red card after half an hour goes a long way towards that. But even so, it was incredibly impressive how comfortable it was and how it didn't feel like... You know, when you record a big victory, often you think, well, this is just a one in a million. You know, we're never doing that again. Like that 5-1, it just felt like a kind of crazy day where everything went right. This just felt... This reminded me, like, obviously, take away all the circumstances and everything and the emotion. It was very similar to the 3-0 win over Crystal Palace on Boxing Day, which you'd file in the, yeah, not really going to remember that game, complete non-event. It was just totally routine. And it was actually very similar because Palace got a man sent off in the first half in that game as well. But it was just strange. Like, the only thing missing from it, really, not that any Spurs fans would want this, because why would you want the stress, was any sense of competition in the game. No jeopardy, yeah, because from the moment the second goal went in, and of course, as fans, especially Spurs fans, you're going to be extremely fatalistic, and I'm sure the vast majority is still saying, I know we're 2-0 up, I know they've got a man down, but we'll find a way to mess this up. But rationally, and especially once the third goal went in, it was just blissfully comfortable, which I don't think, of all, you know, going into the game, I think everyone thought, whatever happens, it's going to be stressful, it's going to be tense, it's going to be horrific to watch. And in the end, it was none of those things.
I guess Spurs were just far more clinical in the big moments. I mean, as Charlie was saying, Arsenal had a lot of the ball in the first sort of 10, 15 minutes. And I suppose it's sort of clinical and pre-clinical. They had a lot of the ball, but didn't really create any good openings in that spell. I don't know if they even had a shot. I wasn't watching on TV, so I didn't see the stats. But it felt like one of those moments where Sky would have flashed up.
You know, last 10 minutes possession.
Arsenal possession, yeah. Last 80% possession in the first 10 minutes or whatever. I mean, it really felt like it could have been like that. But they didn't really have any cutting edge. And, you know, obviously Spurs' first goal was a penalty and maybe a slightly soft one. But, you know, they took that chance, very quickly took a second, and then the game is gone. And I think this Spurs team, once they're in front, especially 2-0 up, we know how deadly they are on the counter-attack, and I think every other team will be conscious of that. I think it's very hard to see a way back for an opposition team, particularly with 10 men from there. The chat around me at half-time was very much, we take 2-1 now and, you know, walk away from this, you know, washing our hands of it. And clearly that very quickly changed when Son scored. But it was just a competent performance from front to back, wasn't it? There wasn't, you know, it's kind of like we were saying about Anfield, that it would be hard to pick a man of the match. I don't think, you know, there were a lot of good performances out there, but it wasn't like that there was one standout player. It was like a kind of consistent level of performance for every team.
Well, that's what made it so interesting to me, was that we've seen Spurs win big games before through like incredible energy and commitment and everybody playing out of their skin and everything. Whereas I can't really... I'd be interested to hear your guys' take on this, but I can't remember the last time Spurs won a game this big where they won it through canniness and experience and clinicism and then closing out the game like that. It's not really something that Tottenham have done an awful lot of, I think, in the last few years.
I'd say, yeah, probably the North London derby last season, that 2-0 win just before Christmas, when similarly they kind of kept Arsenal at arm's length. But that was, I guess, slightly different because that was a really good defensive... That was when they were still playing like Højbjerg and Sissoko, just sitting in front of the back four and restricting the opposition. But yeah, I mean, I said to Jack after the game, I thought... It was odd because normally after a win like that, you come off being like, oh, wow, wasn't Kane incredible? Remember that Dier block? Remember that Lloris save? And, you know, didn't Højbjerg boss things? And Højbjerg did play well, as it happens. But it didn't feel like that kind of game where you're sort of raving about individual performances. As James said, it was controlled competence from front to back. And in the piece I wrote from the game, it was contrasting Spurs' cool heads against an Arsenal team who came, it felt, looking to show that they were hard and they were tough and they were streetwise and they were no longer this soft touch. And in the end, sort of damaged themselves more with that approach than the opposition. And I think the big incidents, I think the Cedric penalty, that probably is harsh. But I also think if you just jump for that properly, you don't give the ref a decision. And ditto, Rob Holding... Yeah, I mean, Son, there was a bit of a lash out from him earlier as well, but he did it in a way that it was ambiguous enough. Holding made his blindingly obvious.
If I, let's come on to Arsenal's tactics in a second. Just to say, yes, it was one of those games where you could have given everybody in the team 8 out of 10, and there was one word, I think, of credit for Davinson Sanchez to be thrown back into a cauldron like that, having not played, I think, for 3 months as a starter. And I was so pleased that, because, you know, let's be fair. He is no Xavi, is he? But that forward pass, which set up the third goal, he won't get an assist because, of course, it goes past a WWF wrestling goal. but I was so pleased for him that he had an easy evening in the end.
And I did worry for him when, after I think it was about 4 or 5 minutes, there was a moment where Spurs were really struggling to get out, and he got the ball, and he was clearly like just. Obviously, the crowd wanted him to be Romero and go and do a Romero thing. And he was, you know, clearly didn't have the confidence to do that. And I think he ended up coming back to Lloris. And the crowd got on his back already. And at that point, I was thinking, Christ, it's going to be a really difficult evening if they're this nervous and anxious. And yet, you know, they managed to find a way to get through it.
I mean, that would definitely could have been a problem, couldn't it? Yeah. Sanchez on the right of the free and Royale on
Martinelli found spaces between them in the first 10 minutes or so. And after that, it wasn't such a problem, but...
Yeah, they tightened up a little bit. And Royal, I mean, look, he probably wasn't quite Anfield levels from him again, but he was very... It was a very competent performance again from him, a good performance.
And he bought a brilliant, brilliant save out of Arsenal's goalkeeper in the second half as well.
I mean, though, just say on Sanchez as well, his last two starts were the Southampton and Wolves defeats at home. You know, so, pretty bruising games. And in that Southampton game in particular, him and Royal were awful down the right, you know, really got exposed. And I think everyone was looking at that from a Spurs perspective, thinking, oh God, you know, we lost Romero. And what was interesting, you know, it is a squad game, and Arsenal, as it turned out, them missing Ben White and playing Cedric. I mean, I said to Jack before the game, without Ben White, they have to play one of Cedric or Nuno Tavares. And those two are very, very gettable at. And so it proved with Cedric and indeed Holding, who also isn't a first choice. But then you've got Davinson and Royale, who themselves aren't first choice. You could argue Sessegnon, although now he probably is. But, you know, Royale and Romero, both second choice. Sorry, Royale and Sanchez, both second choice. Both brilliant on the night.
Jack, you know, Aston Villa kicked Spurs. I thought Liverpool did a fair amount of it. Maybe it's getting out there. This is what you have to do. But Arsenal started. It was bonkers, really, because they don't have the players to muscle Spurs about, have they?
I did a piece the other day on something which I mentioned before, which is there's a bit of, you can see a bit of parallels between the sort of early Pochettino Tottenham team and this and Arsenal's Arteta team. And yesterday, I mean, Spurs fans might not like this comparison, but yesterday was a little bit like the Battle of the Bridge, wasn't it? In the sense that they were so, like, Arsenal was so up for, like, we're going to show that we're men, we're going to be aggressive, we're going to take the game to them. And they just lost their heads. Like, it's all very well being like there's a good way to be aggressive and a bad way to be aggressive. And there's a good way to be snide and a bad way to be snide. And Arsenal just got it all wrong, not for the first time this season. They just didn't know. I don't think they've got the experience or the intelligence or the like the mental balance to play with that kind of physical aggressive game. Like the way that the holding and Son thing.
It felt like ahead of the, you remember ahead of the 2015 election, the UK election, when Ed Miliband did his "Am I tough enough? Hell yes, I'm tough enough," and everyone laughed. It was this kind of, I'm going to show you how tough I really am. That it kind of felt like that from us. It was like, we'll show you guys. And Holding's attempts with a kind of "Am I tough enough?" equivalent. I mean, you've just absolutely done yourself there. It was bizarre.
But you do wonder. Was all that done with like Romero's presence in the Spurs team in mind? Like thinking like, let's make it that kind of ultra niggly game and hope we can get this guy sent off, which would be definitely have been a thing we all would have worried about. Then the second that guy's not in the team, it's just like completely gone out the
window. I know, I did think that if obviously Romero missing was a huge, huge blow, but whether, you know, of all the players, he's probably the one you'd most expect might lose their heads. And yeah, without him there, it was Arsenal had a free run at losing their heads.
And don't forget, you know, Arsenal would have had a Brazilian cutting inside and running out. Yeah. So, I mean, that definitely could have got a bit spicy.
Son, of all people for Holding to pick on, I know why he's doing it, because he's so fast, he's so skillful, but it's often overlooked how bloody strong Son is as well. He's like a bull. And so the rest of the matches were drawing the attention of the referee. I personally thought he was risking a red card with the knee in the back. But you know, it was a local derby. It was early on, and VAR didn't look at it.
When that, because that happened quite like down in front of mine in the press box, I thought that was going to get VAR.
Me too.
He did kind of kick him on. He kicked him in the back on purpose. He did, and it was clear from that point that, you know, he wanted to make his physical impression on Son. And I imagine Son would have been delighted with how it went. Son got everything he wanted out of it. It was like he was kind of daring Holding to keep doing it. And Holding was stupid enough to take the bait. It reminded me of that bit in The Departed where they're on the top of the roof and Costigan says to Sergeant Sullivan says to Costigan, "Shoot a cop, Einstein, see what happens." That's what Son was saying to Holding. Elbow me in the face, see what happens. And Einstein Holding actually took the bait.
It was like the analogy I made in the piece of the older brother just suckering in the younger brother and just winding him up, pressing his buttons, and then getting the reward. I mean, we should say for balance as well that Son is no angel and did respond with an elbow that on another day maybe that's getting VAR'd as well. But what was really smart was Son did the thing I remember a young Cristiano Ronaldo used to do, and indeed I'm sure a middle-aged and old in footballing terms Ronaldo still does, but sensing the moment that rather than when you're getting fouled, viewing it as a compliment. And a lot of players get scared and a bit scarred if they're getting kicked a lot. But what the best players do is say, "Great, you want to keep fouling me? I'm going to isolate you. I'm going to keep going at you, keep running at you." And Son just isolated Holding. Holding committed four fouls in half an hour. All were on Son. He's never committed more in a whole game, and he's played 90 minutes.
You wouldn't have seen this because you were in the stadium. On Sky Television, Theo Walcott actually said, "That's the first job done, isn't then? When you're a wide player, you want to get your immediate opponent booked as early as you can."
Yeah. I mean, Arsenal made their hands were forced because they had injuries, but they would have desperately wanted Tomiyasu on Son. Tomiyasu did very well against Son in the reverse North London derby and is a brilliant one-on-one defender. As it was, because Tierney's out, they've got him putting fire, and they don't trust Tavares, they've got Tomiyasu putting out fires on the left. But it meant that Cedric Holding, which is really a Carabao Cup level axis, was up against Son, and that was such a mismatch. And I guess Holding and or Arteta thought, well, the way we counterbalance that is to try and rough him up, but it didn't work.
Yes, and on the red card for Rob Holding, I can see Fabinho somewhere in his house and I go, "That's not an elbow, is it? Proper elbow? Come on, barely touched him. Yeah, he's hardly caught him across the face at all there.
Fabinho, clever snide. Fernandinho,
but,
clever
yeah, that's
snide.
Exactly it, isn't it?
Arsenal, yeah. Like stupid snide.
But that's the difference between Liverpool and Arsenal. Well, not the difference, one of the differences between it. Liverpool are very, very good, and City as well, by the way. Very, very good at being snide. You look at, you know, Fernandinho is like king snide.
The
Rodri gets away with it.
I've got nothing. I've got no real moral objection to that sort of play. You know, great. You know, Tottenham. Lots of good teams have played like that. I think it If you,
it was a big part of Pochettino's team.
Exactly. The fact is, like, so many great players in the Premier League era, like, but even play, like, I don't know, Bergkamp, David Silva, like, even players who we know, who we kind of, Van Persie, Kane, even players who we know and love for their technique and skill have got a nasty physical edge. But if you're going to do it cleverly. Don't do it stupidly.
I also think you earn the right to do that. I think in referees' eyes, if it is a Fabinho or a Rodri or a Fernandinho, you kind of look at them as these elite players who play for these elite teams and you think, I don't know, there's a little bit of doubt as to whether, are they really doing that? But they play for the best teams. I'm not sure. When it's a team in that period, and you saw that with Spurs as well, often, you know, they got away with it in the Battle of the Bridge, but often refs would be wise to it in the early stages anyway, when they were at this point in their development as Arsenal are. And it's the same thing. I mean, it just feels so writ large. It's like kids trying to play adults, you know, trying to be grown-ups. We're going to try and be streetwise and tough. But the key to doing that is subtlety.
Do we think all of that is why Arteta was so rattled after the game? Was there like a realisation from him? And if you watched the Sky replay of the third goal, which is a dreadful goal for Arsenal to concede, you know, despite what we might say about that Sanchez pass, it's an abysmal goal. It was an abysmal goal to concede. 70 seconds into the second half. On Sky, it cuts to Arteta and he is just like, just completely gone. There's this glazed expression and he just looks absolutely crestfallen. I do wonder whether all of that like leaning into the shithousing when they're probably not especially well equipped to do it, might have been like a big tactical boo-boo.
I think he instantly regrets. And I think his kind of Jose Mourinho style passive aggression to Jeff Rees after the game and in other interviews reflected, I thought he had, and we're here to talk about Spurs, but they would benefit, it's worth doing Arteta because we benefited from it. That wasn't, look, the decision to rush Spurs up must have been, he must have been involved with that. It backfired. The halftime team talk, whatever, they can see another goal. He does, you're right, look glazed. But the moment for me is when he and three others appear to be having some kind of board meeting about what to do about the red card. Now, look, it's professional football. You get a sending off in any other position except goalkeeper or centre-half. You wait to see what happens. Goalkeeper centre-half, you have to replace them instantaneously. They had a cardboard box and some bits of paper laid out on it, like they're seen in Save It Private Ryan. Where they, you know, they're trying to work.
There's a bit in Apollo 13 where they build that, work out how to build that adapter.
They've got an international centre half on the pitch in Tomiyasu. You have to bring on your weaker fullback, or you stick, you know, Granit Xhaka at fullback, whatever you're going to do. What you don't do is sit there for 7 or 8 minutes watching the thing unfold. And of course, you end up then with the delight of Eddie Nketiah facing his own goal as Harry Kane comes pounding past him for the second goal. Charlie, that they will look back, the Arsenal staff, not just the manager, the Arsenal staff, on a night when they contributed to the team's downfall as well.
Well, it's a very young staff as well. That's the thing. It's not just a young team. You know, often we think of young teams with a veteran, experienced manager, but Arteta is very, very young himself. It's his first job, and I think he will learn loads from this. And I think that the shame of it might be for Arsenal is that he'll make all his mistakes while there and then go off and be great for Barcelona or whoever. Though I think, you know, he is doing a very good job. I mean, I do think...
Hang on. I can't let that pass.
What? He's a Poundland pet, mate.
Barcelona have had, like, Ronald Koeman as their most recent manager. It's hardly...
Yeah, but we're giving you a chance to reverse out of that comment, Charlie.
Sentimental.
Arteta played for Barcelona B.
Did it?
He started at... he's a La Masia graduate. But I think on this occasion, he will... The mistake they made was that a draw for them would have been a fantastic result. And what they needed to do was take the sting out of it rather than kind of try and rile up the players and the fans. They needed to do the opposite of that. And maybe when the emotion subsides, he will regret that. I also think a lot of what he was saying afterwards was heart of hearts, he might know a lot of it was nonsense. But in a way, you know, he's not going to dig out his own players. He needs to...
It's the same as Klopp the other night.
Yeah, exactly. He needs to... They've got two games they need to win, and he needs, you know, that Mourinho siege mentality that we used to hear so much about.
So Conte has now rattled Jurgen Klopp and the Arsenal manager in the space of 5 days. It's been a pretty good... I mean, like, even putting the football aside from the kind of, you know, managers... From the political rivalry of managers standpoint, it's been a pretty good week for for Conte in that sense. And I'm sure, and I kind of said this the other day, I'm sure that's one of, if he's thinking over the next few days, do I actually want to go to PSG next season? I bet he thinks, you know what, it's the Premier League is where it's at. Getting to go face-to-face with teams as good as Liverpool and Arsenal rather than, you know, the sort of drudgery of Liga and having to face...
I did think when he was facing the crowd, when that noise was pouring down, hammering down onto him, I did think even you must look at Son and Kane, listen to that stadium and think, can't be many better places to earn your living.
Right.
You know, of course it's more competitive. I get that. In fact, the point about Arsenal being a great result, that was one of the few bits of comfort I took before the game. They don't draw matches, do they? They've got the least draws of any team in the Premier League. So they would either win the game, which meant they must have been coming at Spurs, which I think would suit Spurs, or they'd lost the game. So I held on to that. Talk to me about the post-match. We talked about Conte post-match. Arteta, of course, had gone into his siege cocoon. We get that. Did Conte have to dig him out about moaning?
Yeah, I think Conte... He's actually generally been quite... Unless he's been absolutely berating himself and his team and the club, he's generally been pretty reserved. Like, he hasn't gone head-to-head, toe-to-toe with any other managers. You know, he did a bit of it regards Klopp, but that was a couple of days after the event, so he'd cooled. But he absolutely went for him, and it really... I think it was quite a big moment, potentially, in... Certainly, it just felt like he was... very proud of his team and of the club, and he didn't want to be messed about, and he really wanted to make this point to Arteta, and the postponement has clearly massively rankled with him, you know, as it has done with everyone at Spurs. We saw the statement, and obviously we know how the fans feel, and understandably so. It was a farce, that postponement, and so I think he had a lot of grief, and in so doing he had a lot of other grievances he wanted to get off his chest, and he use the device that Mourinho used to use a lot of, praeterito, when you basically say, you talk about something by saying, I'm not talking about it. So, you know, I'm not going to stand here and talk about the Labour Party's terrible record in government. And obviously by doing that, you're mentioning it.
And sorry, he said that. He was like, what is the rhetorical phrase for that?
Praeterito.
Thank you. I'm just writing that down. Thank you very much.
It comes from the Latin praeterio, which means I overlook. And Cicero used it a lot. What an orator he was, by the way. But yeah, he... Yeah, I mean, so Conte was able to say, you know, I haven't done any complaining about the Fabinho fouls, or about the fact that we're playing Burnley at midday on Sunday, or about the fact that the game was postponed. So, yeah, I think he had a lot of things he wanted to get off his chest, and Arteta's moaning gave him the perfect platform to do that.
I mean, it was a fabulous night, a fabulous result, fabulous performance, almost dreamlike at times when... I, heavily medicated, was able to relax. 40 minutes to go in a North London derby, and you've got your feet on the corner of the coffee table. I don't think so. Really, really good. Our personal experiences of getting to and from, you've heard mine, from ambulance to ecstasy in the space of 6 hours. Jack, you got into a situation comedy style, an ITV situation comedy style issue on the way home.
This was just after I left you, Jack, as well, so I'm really sad I missed it.
Yeah, so I was, me, Charlie, and a few other journalists, we got the train from White Hart Lane to Seven Sisters. Then I hope Charlie doesn't mind my saying, he took the Victoria Line northbound, whereas I took the Victoria Line southbound. So on the southbound platform, and there were hundreds and hundreds of Spurs fans there. This was about 11:45. You know, very raucous, very loud, very drunk. And there was a bloke next to me who was in rhythm with the Antonio, Antonio chanting, was hammering the big metallic sign saying Seven Sisters Tube. Now, I didn't realise this for a few seconds.
The roundel, I believe, is a technical term.
There you go.
And if you want to know the wrong YouTube videos.
Clearly. And every time he did it, it kind of sent a plume of black dust that had been collecting behind the roundel, probably for decades.
Lovely.
Spurting all over me. And so I, all of a sudden I was like, I was just trying to ignore all this chanting going on around me. And all of a sudden my hands and arms were covered in black filth. And then I looked around and like, I was with Dan Kilpatrick from the Evening Standard and Miguel Blaney from the Independent. And they looked at me a bit funny. And my face and neck and bag and coat and hat were also covered in black dust. And I looked at this guy and I was like, come on, mate. Like, and he said, he kind of half apologized. And he said, next time. I don't even know what that means.
No.
An apology, like, next time you're not going to cover me in film. And then, worst of all the Spurs fans got on the tube and I had to kind of try to clean myself. And so using Miguel Delaney's hand sanitizer, a bottle of water, and Dan Kilpatrick's face mask, I basically gave myself an impromptu kind of wash down on the tube platform.
Did it not all just congeal?
Yeah, it did. God. Trying to get this black lava dust from behind the tube sign off my arms, face, and neck. And the worst thing is, if you'd been like an ordinary Spurs fan around the tube station at that point, and you saw me, you must have thought, the state of that bloke.
Yeah.
And it's like, it wasn't even my fault. And that's the worst thing, is like coming, eventually, you know, got the tube back to Bermondsey and then an Uber home from Bermondsey. And like, you know, I had to have a shower, and I thought, like, if I'm going to come home covered head to toe in filth, I want to have got some fun to it.
You watched Spurs smash Arsenal 3-0.
Yeah.
I just didn't enjoy the process of being defiled by tube station dust.
Have we checked Twitter to see whether someone said, I saw that Jack Pitbrook from the Athletic on the tube after the game and he was absolutely filthy?
Listen, let's have a quick break and we'll come back to what remains. I mean, who knew? The number of seasons during my lifetime have come down for satisfaction reasons, and in this case for really important points reasons, the games between Spurs and Arsenal. This clash has been a long time coming, as some of you wrote yesterday. But now we have two games left of the season, and we'll look forward to for both the North London teams right here on a very interesting, slightly COVID-y, and I'm loving the fact that Jack was covered in, I hope too, a lot of it was the oil from the trains over the years as well. I really would like to have a proper investigation into what that consisted of.
It was quite sticky. It was quite sticky dust.
Yeah.
It wasn't just thin dust. It was kind of black, claggy,
I tell you
thick
what's bad.
Dust.
You know, on the escalator, like the handle thing, the runner thing, you get that kind of, sometimes you get that kind of escalator juice, on your jacket or something. That's I bet
It was like that,
similar,
but worse and much more of it, and it covered my
On the scale of perfume to bin juice, where would you put it?
Oh.
I'd say like 80% of the way to bin juice. It just wasn't as liquidy, it was more.
No. Okay.
Is it? I mean, it's probably not worth thinking what that is, because obviously
don't
dust
think
is
about
like
it.
Sort of
don't think about it. Though,
skin and stuff isn't.
And
it?
Also,
probably like
rat
fingernails.
Skin,
yeah,
mouth.
Yeah. What that stuff must have seen over the years as well. If that dust could.
And
talk.
Then it ends up on Jack.
Would Seven Sisters have been like an air raid shelter? Might have been. I guess it probably.
You think there's quite a lot of dead bodies in there as well? Do you?
Well, no, but more of it, like, you know, during the war, people would have been camping out down there overnight.
That's what I mean, the stories the dust would have.
Yeah, exactly.
And amazing. If you start to grow a second head, Jack, in the next few weeks, we'll know why, won't we? Back in a second here on The View from the Lane.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Yeah, welcome back to The View from the Lane, where we're fully loaded today with me, Danny Kelly, Charlie Eccleshare, Jack Pitbrook and James Moore. Well, we all know what a defeat for Spurs would have meant. And now we're back into this two-horse run-in and the horrible drama and tension was effectively a sort of playoff.
Yeah, I was going to say as well, Danny, after you mocked me for saying that that point could end up being valuable at Liverpool, there is a scenario where it could come into play still. If Arsenal lose to Newcastle, which is not impossible, it means Spurs could get away with 4 points rather than six from the last two games. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the point they got at Liverpool. But looking immediately ahead to taking it one game at a time, of course, looking immediately ahead to Sunday, we all know what happened the last time Spurs played Burnley. They were off the back of an arguably even greater victory, the 3-2 at Man City, and they went and lost. So I don't think there'll be any complacency. And Conte talked about, obviously after the game, saying to the players, enjoy tonight, but you know we've got a big game. It's a horrible turnaround. And I think Conte's got every right to be, well, as I always say with this, blame the clubs who accept the ludicrous amounts of money to be messed around. That's where the anger should be directed at, rather than the television companies, because who knew television companies want to make money? But it is a rubbish turnaround, and that does present a challenge, especially against a team who, I mean, Tarkovsky's big. I don't know if it's known yet whether he's going to play. If he's out, I think that's massive for Spurs. If he does play, then that's a tough game, you know, against a team with a huge amount to play for and who have looked a lot better since bringing in Mike Jackson.
The mad thing about the turnaround is that it's the early game when Spurs played on the Thursday night, when there were, like, I think, like eight Premier League games on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Or seven, I guess it must be. I can't really fathom why the Spurs game would be the one that they moved to.
Because it's
all the others are at
because two. That's the slot.
I mean, I know it's a TV.
That's
thing.
The slot.
Yeah, but there'll be a TV game on at two, presumably. And one.
No, there's not one at two. There's one at 4:30, which is Sky, but BT's slot is 12. BT don't give a crap about the short turnaround. They want the game they want, and because they pay a huge amount of money to the clubs, and the clubs are only too happy to accept that money, they accept being shafted. And the managers and clubs don't complain when they have all that money to outspend every club on the continent. At times like this, it is frustrating. But that's why the clubs need, you know, if the clubs cared about the welfare of their players, they'd say, all right, we'll take a bit less money, but we'll have a bit more power so that we don't have crap turnarounds like this.
I mean, it goes without saying that is the benefit of being 3-0 up after 40
seconds. Yes, well, that's...
Obviously, like Son and Kulusevski both came off after, what, like 75? And I mean, the second half was kind of a bit of a procession.
Totally.
Anyway. And I think they overexerted themselves, like chasing lost causes or whatever, in that second half.
But they had half an hour where they were able to treat it as a training exercise, weren't they? Of being compact defensively and then just moving the ball about, hoping that somebody would make a breakthrough at the other end. I mean, it was interesting.
Which is massive. That is massive.
And the taking off of Son, who was clearly upset by it, let's be honest. He was clearly upset. He's now got into his head that he's going for the golden boot as well in a team sport, if you don't mind. It was surprising. Son is such an incredible professional and, you know, decent bloke. He really was acting up, wasn't he?
Mm. He can be emotional. I mean, we've seen him in the way that he, you know, has picked up a few red cards and kind of lashed out, I guess, sort of an extension of that. And the cliche, you know, but you'd be disappointed if your players weren't angry to be substituted. I think he desperately wants the golden boot. He sensed that there were more goals in that. But as Conte said to him, you've now just got to score against Burnley.
Was that the first time we've seen anything close to dissent from Son?
Yeah, I think so.
I can't think of another example. I mean, admittedly, he never really gets taken off that much. So there have been fewer chances to see that kind of thing.
Maybe not like dissent, but it famously in Pochettino's book, he talks a bit about being so annoyed with Son. Like the way he tailed off towards 15-16.
Oh, yeah.
The way he played in that Newcastle game, which I know is a slightly different thing, but clearly there was an evidently minor issue.
Well, he nearly left, didn't he? That's something.
There was also the Lloris contretemps against Everton in 2020.
Oh, yeah. Which
you could
turns out he's Joey same. Barton, this fella.
Yeah.
Is it quite telling that much like against Leicester at 3-0, where Conte made sort of similar substitutions towards the end of the game, Kane, I think, played the whole game in that game as well and played the whole game last night. I mean, I know the way he plays is very different.
Sorry. But is it telling? Yes, it is. There's the answer okay. to that.
He's won that back pretty quick, hasn't he? He's won the power back quite quickly, Kane. If he's,
interesting, too, those of us watching on the TV, I'm pretty sure you don't get to see in the stadium, you're seeing a much better fun thing. But I was the person who took it upon themselves to comfort Son, it wasn't one of the 74 coaches. It was Gallini, wasn't it?
Yeah, I saw this because we've got little TVs in the press box, and I happened to glance down at this point when Son had gone off, because it did look like he was quite angry, so I was curious his reaction. Yeah, there was Gallini giving him this pep talk. I mean,
he's
Gallini
the Son whisperer.
Yeah, well, he's the kind of glue in the dressing room, isn't he? He's the Pepe Reina, the sub keeper who just gets everyone going and is, you know, vital to the dynamic.
Oh, a man who knows a thing or two about being sat on the bench.
I mean, Gallini was at Dele Alli's birthday a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
He's clearly, you know, he's enjoyed his time over here, even if he...
Sorry, whose birthday?
Dele Alli.
Oh, yeah.
He's a bloke who played for Spurs.
And who was going to get a very important gain on the goal the last day of the season.
Exactly, that is true.
I rarely get into the opposition about, you know, what other teams are going to do, because to me, you know, the only thing you can control is yourselves, and Spurs got to win their two football matches. Charlie, thank you for reminding me via some extraordinary algebra, there's a way in which Spurs don't have to win their matches. But let's say I think they probably have to win both of them. And I normally don't bother with what the opposition are going to do because that's out of our control. But in this case, because we just played Arsenal, I think it is worthwhile because they're our local rivals, all those things. Jack, how do you think Arsenal respond to last night? Is it possible even to have an opinion about that?
That bad run of defeats they had a few weeks ago, they obviously responded pretty well to, with the surprising wins against Chelsea and Manchester United. So football teams, ultimately, their mentalities are more up and down. It's not like terminally bad just because they happen to play really badly in this game. So I think there will be a response of sorts. I'm kind of torn in two different directions on this game. Like, Arsenal obviously got the firepower to do a lot of damage against Newcastle. At the same time, they're a very brittle team, and there's huge question marks about their defence. The fact is, I don't really know enough about Newcastle or Arsenal to make an informed prediction, so it's kind of difficult to call.
I mean, Arsenal's defence, if Gabriel is out, and obviously, you know, obviously went off injured last night, and we don't know the extent of that yet, Holding is going to be suspended, which may not be a good bad
advantage Arsenal, yeah.
I think maybe Ben White is going to come back. But, I mean, their defence is still going to be... It's still going to have Cedric in it. I don't know if Nuno Tavares or whatever his name is going to end up playing as well. Oh, it's not going to be a great defence.
Oh, that's disastrous. I mean, when Gabriel went off, and I took a bit of flack on Twitter for saying that's a huge bonus for Spurs, you know, it was said, like, how dare you celebrate injuries? I mean, it's a zero-sum game. I'm sure Arsenal fans weren't... Oh, how do they feel when Romero is out injured? I'm sure they won't say, oh, poor Romero, I do feel for him.
Great
with that
player.
Injury.
You know, what a shame we won't see him playing, yeah.
But that's enormous. That means Arsenal's only available centre-back is a half-fit Ben White. They'll have to move Tomiyasu, who's their only good available full-back, into centre-back. That means they have to play both Tavares and Cedric. Both of those two are disaster zones. I mean, that honestly, that's huge if Gabriel can't make it. And, you know, a guy going off with a hamstring issue 4 days or whatever it was ahead of the next game, that's really big. On the psychological point, I think Arsenal... They've shown both the good and bad. You know, they've tended to have defeats in clusters this season. So, you know, you extend that logic and are they still going to be feeling the effects of that? On the other, as Jack says, they have bounced back well at times. You know, you think of coming out of nowhere from those three defeats. And, you know, these are elite athletes. And, it's very easy to impose one's own kind of frailty onto these guys. You know, obviously, if that were me, I would just be so gutted from having lost one game. I'd barely be able to play the next. And that
yes,
would, you
we've
know,
seen you after you've
formality.
Lost the quiz occasionally, and required hospitalisation.
Yeah. We can talk about this now, can't we? If you were wondering why Charlie sounded so down on Monday, it's because we recorded the podcast immediately after Charlie had lost the final of the Intertotally quiz. And
we literally had to put him on a drip just to get him through the podcast. It was extraordinary.
my wife that evening described me as a pathetic mess, which was
so you're going up in her estimation then.
Yeah, exactly. It was definitely an improvement. But yes, I mean, hopefully for their sake, you know, these professionals are slightly stronger in the head.
If you think about what most of them have had to go through to become top professional footballers, their single-mindedness, I think, is very, very hard to overestimate. They really are pretty tough cookies, and we're led to believe by the professional pundits, oh, Rob Holding will be inconsolable. He'll be very quiet in the corner. Of course, they'll all be surrounding him in the dressing room as soon as they get Arteta's back turned and calling him every kind of wanker under the sun, won't they? In order to rehabilitate him back into the group as quickly as possible.
This is what I found funny about City, how a lot of people were saying after they went out of the Champions League, it was like, can they recover mentally from this? And it was like, I get that, but it's also Man City who are, you know, they're just so strong and resilient.
Brilliant.
What did they do? And brilliant. Yeah. They pit themselves up and beat Newcastle 5-0.
Do we think that Tottenham need... I did accidentally call Tottenham we. Do we think that Tottenham, or we, whatever, need Arsenal to drop points against Newcastle? Because it looks like Everton are going to be safe by the final day, which means that we might get one of those classic who are we seeing at DC10 tomorrow night, last day of the season performances from Everton at the Emirates.
Yeah, I suppose those go two ways though, don't they? Because you do sometimes see like last game of the season when the pressure's off. You know, maybe Everton just go on the front foot in that game and get a goal early and go 1-0 up, and then suddenly it becomes really horrible for Arsenal. I mean, you do see that sometimes. So the reality is Everton are as good a team as Everton are.
Yeah,
that is going to be like the biggest impediment for
them away from home. You wouldn't trust this Everton team to bring you a tea and biscuit, would you? So if Arsenal are to slip, it has to be at Newcastle. So that the 5-0 by Manchester City actually, I think, might do Spurs a favour. A lot of these Newcastle players are playing to be in the squad next season, and it's their last home game. And we know the mood around Newcastle fans at the moment is pretty triumphalist. I hope that they can get something approaching the atmosphere that was at White Hart Lane or the Spurs Stadium last evening and put some pressure on Arsenal. You know, in the end, let's be honest, Arsenal are a better football team, and if that prevails, then so be it. But
I should say as well, I mean, you know, saying there's no guarantee that they'll be so psychologically scarred, but that doesn't mean it's impossible.
No.
You know, as I said, they've lost games in clusters, and there is a huge amount of pressure. They'd only be human if there was an element of thinking we were so close and now we've gone from a 4-point lead to being behind, as they could well. You know, if Spurs do what they need to do.
Just look at Leeds' players just throwing themselves into a kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
...volcano in the last few days, you know?
Yeah.
Also, look... We've all watched enough football to know your mindset in the first 2 minutes of a game can completely change in the second 2 minutes. If something goes up, any little thing goes Arsenal's way early in that game. Like, it doesn't even have to be that they go in front. But anything that just gives them a scent that they're going to do well, like, it could completely change your mindset. And then your mentality, you forget about... I refuse to believe that professional footballers are thinking about the previous game. Once that game has actually started and they're playing, I don't think they're thinking about last Thursday.
I mean, obviously, the stupidly quick turnaround doesn't suit Spurs in one way, but I'm glad that it's Spurs who are playing first now. And if they do their stuff, that's not a given against Burnley. We've seen that already. That's another bit of pressure they can put on Arsenal by getting the points together. Does anybody know?
Yeah, I spoke to Harry Kane about this last night the game, and he made exactly that point that he would... he's happy that Spurs are playing first this weekend. He thinks it suits them. And he thinks they can make their... He said, I think I'd rather be going first and second, of course. We still need to go out there and win on Sunday. Otherwise, it makes Arsenal's job a lot easier. But if we can do that on Sunday, of course, it makes their game a lot tougher on Monday away from Newcastle. So I think Spurs will be, you know, I think Spurs will be happy that they've got the opportunity to go fourth briefly on Sunday and then kind of force Arsenal to need to win at Newcastle.
They'd probably just rather it was at 4:30 rather than midday. Should say as well, there is a 2 televised game, but that's also Sky. So yeah, it's basically the fact that it's the only game on BT is why they're at that silly slot.
It's Jake Humphrey's fault.
Blame Jake Humphrey, basically, yeah.
This has been an extraordinary podcast that we've had a chance to discuss Spurs thrashing Arsenal. I've been able to describe how I have fought the good fight against the evil virus. And Jack has told us about getting generations of people's discarded nasal hair and earwax off of himself on the underground. So it seems almost banal to ask the next question. Did we know that Romero was injured, and is that him done for the season?
Yeah, so after the game, Conte did say he doesn't expect Romero to play again this season. You know, obviously only a week left, which is a really big shame, and they've got injury. You know, it's a very small pool of players they've got to choose from. It was already small.
But that's true of many clubs just now, isn't it? They've all been worn out, haven't
they? Totally. And I do think, hopefully Sanchez, after the way he played yesterday, that's not quite as terrifying a prospect as it was sort of when the team news dropped. But yeah, I do think just looking ahead to those games, for Arsenal, you know, obviously we can't quantify this, but they'd have been better off losing by a bigger scoreline, but not losing those two centre-backs. You know, that's... Speaking to James McNicholas, who covers Arsenal for The Athletic, he was saying that's the thing potentially even more damaging, because they could afford to lose the game in a sense. They couldn't really afford to lose two defenders, and that could be that could turn last night for them into a bad one, into a catastrophic one. And by extension, you know, all of those associated benefits that come from that for Tottenham.
We all know predicting football matches is a mug's game. So I'm going to start with you, Charlie, because you've at least been consistent. Who's going to finish a fourth?
I'm sticking with Spurs. And can I say as well, Conte said yesterday in his press conference, he said, after we lost to Burnley, no, you know, who could have thought we'd have been here? And I wanted to send him my tweet after the Burnley game saying, still think Spurs will get top four. So obviously afterwards I tweeted it with the quote. But yeah, so of course I'm sticking with Spurs. This is what I said would play out, that they just needed to, that even if they lost to Liverpool, that wasn't the big deal. The big deal was, could they win the derby? Could Arsenal drop points at Newcastle?
Is Sunday a must-win game?
Sunday is a must-win game. Even though ultimately it might not prove to be one if Arsenal lose, because then they get 4 points. Yes, it is.
You can't retrospectively...
Yeah, turned out it was a must-win game. Yeah, they've got to win that game. Of course they do.
I won't ask you, James, for fear of bocking it, as they say, south of the Thames.
No, what do you think, James? What do you think? Whose position would you rather be in now?
Whose position? Arsenal's. They've a point ahead. I mean, that's obvious.
But who do you honestly think will get it?
My instinct, genuinely, is that Arsenal will win the two games. Just because I feel like that this sort of defies logic. But to me, it feels like Arsenal are very good at getting over the line in these kind of situations. I mean, I feel like we've seen this a few times, and it'll be completely different players and manager and staff.
Long time since they've got over the line in this situation.
Maybe. I just think they're going to win the two games quite narrowly. If I might scrap it, I think they'll probably do it. But what I would say is I would be incredibly confident that Spurs will finish ahead of Arsenal next season.
Yeah, do you get the feeling like I do that I said last week or earlier this week that if the season went on, maybe Chelsea would be catchable? I definitely feel like if the season went on much... Like Arsenal feel a bit... you know, they're staggering towards the line with a patched up team.
Yeah, even if it... To me, even if it was like four games more than two, I'd be very confident. Maybe Chelsea too. I think I said on the pod at the start of the week, I shared my theory on Chelsea, and clearly they went and won at Leeds incredibly comfortably. So it seems unlikely they're going to lose the last two games. But yeah, Chelsea are wobbling. Who knows what they're going to look like next season? I think Spurs are better than Arsenal. It might weirdly end up not being enough to finish above them in the league, which, you know, sort of... seems a bit counterintuitive, but look, if they had Conte at the start of the season, Spurs would have finished third, and they would have been like comfortably third.
Or they should have sacked Nuno after the derby at the Emirates, the first.
I said they should have sacked him at half time.
They should have sacked him at the Man City.
If they sacked him at half time, and then got Conte in
for the second half,
you know, they'd be on 70 plus points by now.
Yeah, I mean, I take James's point. I think Arsenal can. I can see, you know, 100 ways which Arsenal will win both their games. The romantic in me also sees Kieran Trippier and Dele Alli scoring very important goals in those games. But then when I go down that route, I can see Aaron Lennon scoring for Burnley. So let's go. Leave the last word to you, Jack. Who's going to finish fourth?
I'd rather be Tottenham, I think. 51-49.
It's interesting you say that because what's that website? 538. I think it's they've got it the other
way. Yeah, they've got it like 52-48 to Arsenal.
Something like that. I was surprised it was as close as that.
Bookmakers have Arsenal 11-10 on Spurs at even money, so it's coin tossing time.
I have to say, with 5:38, not sound like a complete dinosaur, but I have found.
There we go.
Well, no, I just look at it sometimes.
It fluctuates a lot. Like it doesn't fluctuate as much as that.
Exactly. Isn't it just kind of telling you what a well-informed fan might be able to tell? You know, because it, before the North London Derby, Arsenal were like 74% to get it, but then they lose. And it's kind of like, obviously, but there was a reasonable chance that Derby result was going to happen. You know, that was kind of what many of us predicted. But anyway.
Yeah, well, I guess I don't know about that or even the XG for these upcoming games. There'll be XD, won't there? There'll be plenty of drama. And hopefully,
that's our metric.
Spurs can come out on the upper side of that. The next podcast will be along soon, and we'll all no doubt either be equally triumphalist and bunting hanging from the ceiling, or we'll be trying to lift our heads off the desk. Thank you very much to the full crew today, James and Jack and Charlie. I'm Danny Kelly, and you are the listening millions. And if you're not already a subscriber to The Athletic, you can sign up right now to read all of our articles on Spurs, as well as the multitude of other stuff that's on the site. Just go to theathletic.com/SpursPod and sign up right now for just £1 a month for 6 months. That's theathletic.com/SpursPod. We'll be back on Monday. Thank you for listening.
The Athletic.